I'm CJ Shern, and welcome back to the New York Jazz Workshop In Conversation With podcast series. And I'd like to present part two of my podcast with drummer and multi-instrumentalist Jerry Gibbs, recorded on September 15th. In this segment coming up, you will hear some amazing stories with musicians such as Kenny Barron and Ron Carter. So the influences on the record, first of all, I will say with Alex Collins, who is just an incredible musician, this record you could almost play like a drinking game how many times he plays the lick on several different tunes, because there's a bunch of tunes where I hear do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Oh, that's funny that you say that, because we always laugh when he plays that.
Yeah, and it's like, so the influences, though, I hear definitely progressive rock, because you've been interested in so many different types of music. Progressive rock, for sure, with Chick Corea, for example, that tune. There's a Mozart influence, at least to my ear, because Chick loves Mozart.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to do that on the next record with the string quartet with the trio.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you something, CJ. It's really, I say progressive rock because of the production and because starting off with something that sounds like the music to Ben Hur and then going into something that would sound like out of a French movie, going into some Weather Reportish type of fusion, mm-hmm, going in mm-hmm. to all of a sudden into a Mozart a classical piece. Progressive rock records had those types of things. Jazz records, some real creative records in the 70s that were maybe not, didn't do that well, but that were loved by a selected group of people like myself.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that was very influenced by that. And so I say progressive rock, but when people hear it, it doesn't sound like a Yes record or a King Crimson record.
True.
Not anything like, it's not that heavy and electronic. Although, I knew that this would, you grow a certain amount of fans. We all have a certain amount of fans. And sometimes those fans go like, what happened? Why did you do that?
Yeah, as a Pat Metheny fan, I know that feeling all too well from not myself, but others, because I love everything that he's done, but I know that feeling
right.
very well. Yeah,
and, as an artist, I would say that, when I made those records with Ron Carter and Kenny Barron, I could have easily made a fusion record with them. I could have made an avant-garde record with them.
Sure.
I could have made all kinds of weird records, whatever I wanted to do. But I had a certain thing that I wanted to do, and I was very specific. I didn't just call them and we jammed. We actually spent a lot of time going through the music, working on it and discussing. Mm-hmm. I would go to Kenny's house, and Kenny would look at it, and we'd talk about different things. I actually, the third, which was the last record, I really wanted to do something that was not really the norm. I took all the elevator music that I grew up listening to in the 70s that you'd hear in the supermarket.
Yeah, yeah.
Da 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 da.
Exactly.
Da 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 da.
Right, I remember that too. Yeah,
and I went to Kenny and Ron. I said, I'm going to record nothing but these tunes. And they said, really? I was like, yeah. They said, well, how are we going to do it? I said, I'm not going to make any arrangements for them. We're just going to interpret them in a real straight ahead swinging way. Because with Ron and Kenny, you can't get better when it comes to swinging. So
absolutely.
So I didn't want to take the element into something else. I wanted to take it into the thing that you have two of the greatest guys that have ever done that particular, thing, and to take these tunes because they could make them into something else. And so I didn't want to make a big arrangement. So I wanted Kenny and Ron to kind of do what they wanted to do. And then I grabbed Cassandra Wilson and Roy Hargrove. And even when I told them, everybody was looking at me like, and I said, and on top of it, we're going to, we're not going to rehearse. We'll discuss it each tune before we do it, which would be normal. You know, spend 5 or 10 minutes going over it, discussing it, talking about it. I said, but we're going to do it in front of a live audience, and it's going to be an audience that we've invited. Mm-hmm. So it'll be all musicians and people that understand what we're doing, and industry people that would understand it. So we got about 100 people each day into Systems 2 recording studio, set up the chairs and the tables and everything. And then we set everything up, and Roy came in, and Cassandra came in, and Ron and Kenny there. And I would give them my basic concept, and then, you know, every once in a while, Kenny or Ron would throw out a voicing or chord and discuss, you know, why don't we, you know, play these chords into this section here. This might lend itself better for soloing, which was great because that's what I wanted. And so where I allowed everybody to throw the ideas out, one of the greatest things about having Ron and Kenny is every time they throw an idea, they'll look at me like, yes or no. If it's no, then they don't even question. They're like so professional. Mm. And you would think that they wouldn't, that they would be bulldozing over me because right. of their millions of years of more experience and being around and being on the highest level ever. But that they really conduct themselves in a way that I guess this is why Ron Carter's ended up on, you know, 2,500 records, because of how he conducts himself in the studio.
Ron gives you exactly what you want.
And he wants to be mm-hmm. able, though, to give you him, too. He doesn't want to, he has a word that he uses, he doesn't want to be an ornament mm-hmm, on your mm-hmm. on your clothes. He wants to have some say in what he does musically. So he gives you everything you want, and then he gives you things you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
Same with Kenny.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember you said that in an interview that I was watching yesterday, that Ron takes information and he gives you exactly what you want, but then injects himself.
Right.
And
you should know that, because that's why you hired him.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's on like Red Clay by Freddie Hubbard or the Miles stuff or Maiden Voyage or the Low End Theory with the Tribe Called Quest, mm-hmm. Ron... personality is on all those things. And actually that's a nice segue into talking about jazz in the 70s. So Ron Carter is the first bass player that I ever heard, because I grew up on jazz. I was blessed to have parents who played it all the time. I heard it in the womb. I had records from the time I was like 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. The first records that I had with Ron on them were Gilberto with Turntine, CTI Summer Jazz at the Hollywood Bowl, which is one of my all-time favorite records, Off the Top by Jimmy Smith. I mean, Ron was on all of these records that I grew up on.
You want to hear a great quick story? You mentioned Red Clay. Lenny sure. White told me this great story about...
The bass drum, right?
No. This is another one that
okay,
nobody
ahead,
talks
man.
About. This go came. Lenny told me this over the telephone a couple weeks ago. So when they were getting ready to record Red Clay, he didn't like the sound of his snare drum, and he wanted to deaden it. And nothing he put on there was what he was looking for. So he just said, "You know what? I'm going to try this." And he ran out to the lobby of Rudy Van Gelder Studios and grabbed the big welcome mat. And he placed the huge welcome. He rolled it up. He put it over half the snare drum, kind of was able to, I guess, maybe run it around the tom-tom so that it wouldn't fall off. He was able to somehow let it, this is what people wipe their feet off when they walked in, put it over a snare drum, recorded Red Clay, took it off, and put it right back in the lobby again.
Are you serious?
That's what he told me, yeah. you know, I mean, those are classics, you know, that's a classic.
Yeah, because I did a podcast with him last summer, and we were talking about Red Clay, and he said how for years he just could not listen to the record because of that weird bass drum that Rudy got for him in the back, because Ron had said, well, no, your oil can bass drum is going to be too resonant. You can't have that with the bass.
Right.
It'll cover up the bass.
Ron's so, very particular about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. But I just mentioned off the top, you told the story on Facebook where Ron had apparently went out and bought a car during the Jimmy Smith session. So what?
Yeah, he just those, they were recording. It was Grady Tate, Stanley Turrentine, Jimmy Smith, Ron, and George Benson. And he was there. And There was a bunch of downtime. They were all hanging out and goofing around and laughing and telling stories.
Chomping on chicken and having a ball.
Yeah. And Ron just said, man, I'll be right back. You know, you guys are going to be here for a while. And he went out and bought a car, and 2 hours later came back, and they were ready to go. He didn't leave because he only left to go get the car because they weren't going to record for the next few hours.
Wow.
So he figured he had a few hours of a break. You know, it wasn't like he just got up and walked out. Everybody said, where was Ron going? He just they were doing stuff, and he didn't need to be there. And they said, yeah, go ahead. And he said, all right, I'll be right back. And he went out 2 hours. They said, yeah. He said, all right. Went out and bought a car and came right back.
Oh, man, that's so funny. And, yeah, so the 70s and jazz, though, you had posted on Facebook that there were a lot of people, I guess from your generation, who didn't know 70s records as well as the 60s records.
Yeah, I might have gotten myself into trouble saying something like that.
Well, that's funny because, you know, I was born in 81, and a lot of the records that I grew up on when I was a kid, there were, you know, all those records from the 70s, like the CTI records, you know, the My Name is Bootsy Baby, you know, all those records that had jazz musicians, you know, Earl Klugh, Living Inside Your Love with, you know, Steve Gadd. I don't like any other Earl Klugh album other than that, actually. But even that one hasn't worn that well to me. But it's like, I just found that sentiment kind of weird because I grew up with a lot of records, and I knew some of those records even before I knew some of the 60s ones, even though I had those too when I was a kid. It's a very funny thing because there's so many good records from that era that need reassessing.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, for me, all of the influences of music, 50s, 60s, 70s, those were the biggest influences, and pretty much everything you hear people doing today is going back, either, it depends on the artist and what, you know, but it's either heavily influenced by music of the 70s, 60s, mm-hmm. 50s, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, those were the three really most influential. When I say influential, I mean, obviously, music in the 30s and 40s is very influential, but I don't, you know, unfortunately, maybe a lot of musicians don't go back that far. They should, but they don't, you know, guys today, they just don't.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so I'm very influenced by it, you know, but I mean, after the 70s, there was some great music in the 80s, 90s, and all the way up till now. But I'm just talking about, a huge, what's the word? I'm such an idiot. Just a huge group of people that influenced the next generations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much stuff I think there are musicians in the 80s that influenced, and some in the 90s that influenced a lot of guys today. But those came out of the 80s that influenced them, they were influenced by music from the 50s and 60s and 70s mm-hmm. and 40s. And let me go back to the 40s because mm-hmm. the bebop era came about there. So I should say that in the 40s, that would be more correct. But a lot of those guys, you know, a lot of the guys that influence a lot of the guys today, like Josh Redman and guys like them, those guys really went back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s to develop what they developed.
Yeah, you just mentioned the thing about some of the people today have been influenced by players of the 80s and 90s when the so-called acoustic jazz young lion movement came back and came into focus. You know, acoustic jazz in the 70s was never really dead because you had albums on black jazz, on Strata East, you know, the Herbie VSOP records, which are fantastic. I love all of those. You know, the ECM records, Jack DeJohnette, all, you know, all people like that. Acoustic jazz was always around.
I wish there were more people and really checking out. Today's younger guys were really checking all the stuff that you just mentioned. Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of younger guys that I play with, I'm turning them on to names like Arthur Blythe and
right.
And to the VSOP recordings and to all the things that happened in the 70s. Because, I mean, I own, in my apartment, I own about 10,000 LPs. It's about 10,000.
Wow.
And I've digitized the majority of them. And then as far as CDs go, I probably have about maybe 6,500. So my home is like a library. People come over and they just say, this is like I'm in a record store. And also a music store, because I have 10 drum sets, two sets of vibes, four and a half octave marimba, mm-hmm. four keyboards, an acoustic bass, a cello. 10,000 percussion instruments.
I got to come to your place sometime.
8 conga drums. Yeah, it's wow. like, and it's all set up, ready to go at all times with all of the music. So there's, you know, I like to try to turn a lot of people on to a lot of these great records that you're talking about.
It's so funny that you said that you have 10,000 records, because people come to my apartment, they see my CD collection, which is only about 1,000 plus. They're like, oh, that's so huge. And I'm like, no, it isn't. You have to look at some of the people.
I'll tell you what's interesting to me, CJ, that's really crazy. I have a recording studio in my place, but I also have very nice, you know, expensive home stereo speakers in both sides of, I have a whole floor. So on one side of the my home, I have one set of Sherwin Vegas, and on the other side, I have a set of JBLs. And they're, you know, they're big speakers. And so when you walk in, there's an incredible sound. Now, I own a bunch of other speakers that I don't use anymore. And I've tried to tell guys, hey, man, I got these speakers. You want to keep them in your apartment? You can, because you're listening to music on a little computer with little computer speakers. And they're like, no, I'm good this way. Thinking to myself, this is a whole nother time. Because when I was 18 years old, everybody had to have a great stereo system in your house. That was more important than where you were going to put your clothes, you know, or where you're going to put your couch.
Sure,
and
sure.
Today, people listen to music on devices that are things that we wouldn't tolerate.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
I would never listen to music on a small computer speakers in my home when I was young. I wouldn't do it now, but I wouldn't do it when I was young. And I can't even give some of these speakers away. Sometimes I have like sets of them. I just don't use them. And I'll ask close friends, like, "Hey, man, let me give you these speakers." And I got an old receiver. You can hook it up to your computer. Just plug it in there. No, I don't have much room, and I'm good. I'm like, I'm gonna let you just hold on to them. I mean, you probably hold on to them for years. Taken. No, I don't. It's like, really?
Yeah, you know, I have. Not everything, but I have a lot of my CDs ripped to my laptop, but I rip everything in Wave.
Well, that's okay, though. That's cool, because you want to have an easy way to hear it.
Yeah, and personally, I still prefer putting the CD in my old Sony PlayStation 3 because it sounds better than the laptop. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with today, we're getting to the point where streaming is such a big thing that the album is a lost art, and people like myself and yourself are kind of dinosaurs because the physical product is still
well, there was
important.
There was a story that somebody that an artist was trying to, they sat there and either them or in some cases a record producer or a record label, they sit there and tried to figure out a reason why they put them in the order they put them in. Mm-hmm. I never did. I never had anybody produce my first record I did for Quincy Jones for Warner Brothers. They let me, Styx Hooper produced it, but he kind of let me do whatever. He just was there to make sure that tape rolled and everything was cool. They let me do the order because I had a story I wanted to tell, you know. And so, yeah, that's true. It doesn't really exist anymore where people hear the whole story. Billy Childs said something that was really profound that he said about what young artists don't get to do anymore, that we got to do, is we all couldn't really afford a lot of music back then. We didn't have access to hear mm-hmm. a whole record. Mm-hmm. So when you got your money together and you went and got an album, you came home. And that was like one of the albums out of maybe 10, 15 that you had. I'm talking about as a kid.
Right.
And so
right.
You listen to those albums over and over and really listen to everything on it. you know, you listen to all the bass notes, all the piano chords, all the comping, all every drum thing that went down. And you,
that's exactly what I did, too.
Yeah, yeah. And you really studied it, and then you fell in love with it more and more. Mm-hmm, it's like going on a date with a woman one time. Can't really fall in love with her, but if you can spend a whole lot of time with her, then maybe you can fall in love with her. So then music, it doesn't, certain records don't have the same falling in love impact because people are on to the next thing so fast.
Right, right, right. So before we wrap up here, one thing I wanted to ask.
You know, I'm not a good rapper, but and I appreciate you. You know that I've done some stuff with rappers, but
You're a good beatboxer, but
I can't. Now that I can do.
So before we wrap it up, you have titled all your bands with Thrasher in them, and I find that so fascinating because actually it'll get people into jazz because people who normally won't listen to jazz will look at that, look at the name, think, oh, that's like a metal band or something like that. And they'll get into the music. So how did you come up with that?
I didn't come up with it. I got a call from Don Pullen. When Don Pullen, George Adams had their band with Cameron Brown and Danny Richmond. Mm-hmm. I saw their last week in Los Angeles, and I had done some playing with Don in Los Angeles. And they got back to New York, and Danny Richmond had died a couple days on return, and the band decided they were going to go out and honor this tour that they had. So Don knew I knew the music. I'd never played with any of those guys, but because I had played with them during that week that he was in Los Angeles in the afternoon, we would go over to the Union, and we'd played like four times during that week that he was in town, almost every day. And he asked me to go out with the band, and I couldn't because I was going out with my dad and Buddy DeFranco. So Don and I stayed in touch. Then Don got ready. I moved to New York. I'd moved to New York maybe a year later. And Don was going to record his record, New Beginnings, with Gary Peacock and Tony Williams. And
on
Tony,
Blue Note in 1985 right, or so, yeah.
And that was in
86.
That actually is 88.
88,
yeah, because that's when I first moved here. I did the rehearsals for the record. That's why I know.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool,
Tony
cool.
couldn't do the rehearsals, so I rehearsed with Don and Gary. And Don plays with his fist. You know, he rolls the back of his fist across the keys. Right. And he broke, and I can say this now because Don Sickler knows it. So if he ever hears this, he already knows the story. He basically broke two black notes off, and he asked Gary Peacock and I to go out and make sure nobody was going to walk in while he glued the black notes back on. He carried a kit with him in case this happened because he knew this happened every once in a while. And I said to him, God, Don, you're like a thrasher. And and it was really funny because he was a thrasher. So I had a nickname when I was a kid, which was the Thrasher. I don't want to get into why. It's really stupid.
Sure.
It's really dumb. But anyways, and it was just part of a story. So then Don kind of laughed like, well, no, I'm not the Thrasher. You're the Thrasher. But Don, when I told Don the first story, when Don and George Adams were playing at Half Moon Bay, Don Pullen dedicated a song to the Thrasher and said, but the Thrasher can't expose himself right now. And then George Adams goes, yeah, let's hear it for the Thrasher. And then Danny Richmond goes, the Thrasher, come on out, Thrasher. And everybody's saying, and then the whole audience is going, Thrasher, the Thrasher, where's the Thrasher? It was like a musical kind of weird thing that they did. So this Thrasher kind of, but I called him a Thrasher because he broke notes off the piano. So when I recorded for Quincy's label, I wrote a song for Don and I called it Pullen, P-U-L-L-E-N, then slash the Thrasher. And Quincy thought the title sounded sexual. And he said, can we change the title? Because this is the song that probably will be the radio hit, is Pullen the Thrasher. So can we just change it? And I said, can we call it the Thrasher and dedicate it to Don Pullen? He said, yeah, let's call it the Thrasher. And then he said, came back to me, said, we're going to call the record the Thrasher. I thought, well, that's kind of weird because what does that mean? I'm not known as the Thrasher. And all of a sudden, you know, when you have Warner Brothers money, you go out and you do tours. they subsidize you. And so we got on our first festival in Europe, and it said Jerry Gibbs and the Thrasher Band. It was like, the Thrasher Band? Where'd that come from? And so it just kept staying. And then guys like Randy Brecker, they never would call me by my name. He still calls me Thrasher. So it just kind of, it stayed. And so we all thought, Ravi Coltrane, everybody in the band, we just thought, what are we, a heavy metal band? But we kept it, and I just kept it because more and more people would refer to me as the Thrasher.
That's a great story. That's like, in all the podcasts I've done, that's one of the best stories I've heard. So I would like to thank Jerry Gibbs so much for coming in today. And if you would like more edification on some of the topics that we talked about today, at the New York Jazz Workshop, you can check out the Modern Jazz Ensemble Workshop with Sebastian Noel, Jazz Improvisation 2 with Mark Momus, and the Funk and Fusion Workshop led by bassist Andrea Veneziani. So, for the New York Jazz Workshop in Conversation With podcast series, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody. So, you know, the influences on the record, first of all, I will say with Alex Collins, who is just an incredible musician, this record you could almost play like a drinking game, how many times he plays the lick on several different tunes, because there's a bunch of tunes where I hear do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Oh, that's funny that you say that, because we always laugh when he plays that.
Yeah, and it's like, so the influences, though, I hear definitely progressive rock, because you've been interested in so many different types of music. Progressive rock, for sure, with Chick Corea, for example, that tune. There's a Mozart influence, at least to my ear, because Chick loves Mozart.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to do that on the next record with the string quartet with the trio.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you something, CJ. It's really, I say progressive rock because of the production and because starting off with something that sounds like the music to Ben Hur, and then going into something that would sound like out of a French movie, going into some Weather Reportish type of fusion, mm-hmm, going in mm-hmm. to all of a sudden into a Mozart a classical piece. Progressive rock records had those types of things. Jazz records, some real creative records in the 70s that were maybe not, didn't do that well, but that were loved by a selected group of people like myself,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
really, you know, that was very influenced by that. And so I say progressive rock, but when people hear it, it doesn't sound like a Yes record or a King Crimson record.
True.
Not anything like, it's not that heavy and electronic. Although, I knew that this would, you know, you grow a certain amount of fans. We all have a certain amount of fans, and sometimes those fans go like, "What happened? Why did you do that?"
Yeah. As a Pat Metheny fan, I know that feeling all too well from not myself but others, because I love everything that he's done, but I know that feeling
right
very well. Yeah.
And as an artist, I would say that, you know, when I made those records with Ron Carter and Kenny Barron, I could have easily made a fusion record with them. I could have made an avant-garde record with them.
Sure.
I could have made all kinds of weird records, whatever I wanted to do. But I had a certain thing that I wanted to do, and I was very specific. I didn't just call them and we jammed. We actually spent a lot of time going through the music, working on it and discussing. Mm-hmm. I would go to Kenny's house, and Kenny would look at it, and we'd talk about different things. I actually, the third, which was the last record, I really wanted to do something that was not really the norm. I took all the elevator music that I grew up listening to in the 70s that you'd hear in the supermarket.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know.
Exactly.
You know.
Right. I remember that too. Yeah.
And I went to Kenny and Ron. I said, I'm going to record nothing but these tunes. And they said, well, what do you, really? I was like, yeah. They said, well, how are we going to do it? I said, I'm not going to make any arrangements for them. We're just going to interpret them in a real straight ahead swinging way. Because with Ron and Kenny, you can't get better when it comes to swinging. So
absolutely.
So I didn't want to take the element into something else. I wanted to take it into the thing that you have two of the greatest guys that have ever done that particular, you know, thing, and to take these tunes because they could make them into something else. And so I didn't want to make a big arrangement. So I wanted Kenny and Ron to kind of do what they wanted to do. And then I grabbed Cassandra Wilson and Roy Hargrove. And even when I told them, everybody was looking at me like, and I said, and on top of it, we're not going to rehearse. We'll discuss it each tune before we do it, which would be normal. You know, spend 5 or 10 minutes going over it, discussing it, talking about it. I said, but we're going to do it in front of a live audience, and it's going to be an audience that we've invited. Mm-hmm. So it'll be all musicians and people that understand what we're doing, and industry people that would understand it. So we got about 100 people each day into Systems 2 recording studio, set up the chairs and the tables and everything. And then we set everything up, and Roy came in, and Cassandra came in, and Ron and Kenny there. And I would give them my basic concept. And then, you know, every once in a while, Kenny or Ron would throw out a voicing or chord and discuss, you know, why don't we, you know, play these chords into this section here. This might lend itself better for soloing, which was great because that's what I wanted. And so where I allowed everybody to throw the ideas out, one of the greatest things about having Ron and Kenny is every time they throw an idea, they'll look at me like, yes or no. If it's no, then they don't even question. They're like so professional. Mm. And you would think that they wouldn't, that they would be bulldozing over me because right. of their millions of years of more experience and being around and being on the highest level ever. But that they really conduct themselves in a way that I guess this is why Ron Carter's ended up on, you know, 2,500 records because of how he conducts himself in the studio.
Ron gives you exactly what you want.
And he wants to be mm-hmm. able, though, to give you him, too. He doesn't want to, he has a word that he uses. He doesn't want to be an ornament mm-hmm, on your mm-hmm. on your clothes. He wants to have some say in what he does musically. So he gives you everything you want, and then he gives you things you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
Same with Kenny.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember you said that in an interview that I was watching yesterday, that Ron takes information and he gives you exactly what you want, but then injects himself.
Right.
And
you should know that because that's why you hired him.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's on like Red Clay by Freddie Hubbard or the Miles stuff or Maiden Voyage or the Low End Theory with the Tribe Called Quest, mm-hmm. Ron... personality is on all those things. And actually that's a nice segue into talking about jazz in the 70s. So Ron Carter is the first bass player that I ever heard because I grew up on jazz. I was blessed to have parents who played it all the time. I heard it in the womb. I had records from the time I was like 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. The first records that I had with Ron on them were Gilberto with Turntine, CTI Summer Jazz at the Hollywood Bowl, which is one of my all-time favorite records. Off the Top by Jimmy Smith. I mean, Ron was on all of these records that I grew up on.
You want to hear a great quick story? You mentioned Red Clay. Lenny sure. White told me this great story about...
The bass drum, right?
No. This is another one that okay, nobody ahead, talks man. About. This go came. Lenny told me this over the telephone a couple weeks ago. So when they were getting ready to record Red Clay, he didn't like the sound of his snare drum, and he wanted to deaden it. And nothing he put on there was what he was looking for. So he just said, you know what, I'm going to try this. And he ran out to the lobby of Rudy Van Gelder Studios and grabbed the big welcome mat. And he placed the huge welcome. He rolled it up. He put it over half the snare drum, kind of was able to, I guess, maybe run it around the tom-tom so that it wouldn't fall off. He was able to somehow let it, this is the what people wipe their feet off when they walked in, put it over a snare drum, recorded Red Clay, took it off, and put it right back in the lobby again.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what he told me, yeah. you know, I mean, those are classics, you know, that's a classic.
Yeah, because I did a podcast with him last summer, and we were talking about Red Clay, and he said how for years he just could not listen to the record because of that weird bass drum that Rudy got for him in the back, because Ron had said, well, no, your oil can bass drum is going to be too resonant. You can't have that with the bass. Man. It'll cover up the bass.
Ron's so, very particular about
yeah, that. Yeah, yeah. But I just mentioned off the top, you told the story on Facebook where Ron had apparently went out and bought a car during the Jimmy Smith session. So what?
Yeah, he just those they were recording. It was Grady Tate, Stanley Turrentine, Jimmy Smith, Ron, and George Benson, and he was there. And there was a bunch of downtime. They were all hanging out and goofing around and laughing and telling stories,
chomping on chicken and having a ball.
Yeah, and Ron just said, "Man, I'll be right back. You know, you guys are gonna be here for a while." And he went out and bought a car, and 2 hours later came back, and they were ready to go. He didn't leave because he only left to go get the car because they weren't going to record for the next few hours.
Wow.
So he figured he had a few hours of a break. You know, it wasn't like he just got up and walked out. Everybody said, where was Ron going? They were doing stuff, and he didn't need to be there. And they said, yeah, go ahead. And he said, all right, I'll be right back. And he went out 2 hours. They said, yeah. He said, all right, went out and bought a car and came right back.
Oh, man, that's so funny. And, yeah, so the 70s in jazz, though, you had posted on Facebook that there were a lot of people, I guess from your generation, who didn't know 70s records as well as the 60s records.
Yeah, I might have gotten myself into trouble saying something like that.
Well, that's funny because, you know, I was born in 81, and a lot of the records that I grew up on when I was a kid, there were, you know, all those records from the 70s, like the CTI records, you know, the My Name is Bootsy Baby, you know, all those records that had jazz musicians, you know, Earl Klugh, Living Inside Your Love with, you know, Steve Gadd. I don't like any other Earl Klugh album other than that, actually. But even that one hasn't worn that well to me. But it's like, I just found that sentiment kind of weird because I grew up with a lot of records, and I knew some of those records even before I knew some of the 60s ones, even though I had those too when I was a kid. It's a very funny thing because there's so many good records from that era that need reassessing.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, for me, all of the influences of music, 50s, 60s, 70s, those were the biggest influences, and pretty much everything you hear people doing today is going back, either, it depends on the artist and what, you know, but it's either heavily influenced by music of the 70s, 60s, mm-hmm. 50s, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, those were the three really most influential. When I say influential, I mean, obviously, music in the 30s and 40s is very influential, but I don't, you know, unfortunately, maybe a lot of musicians don't go back that far. They should, but they don't, you know, guys today, they just don't.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
so I'm very influenced by it, you know, but I mean, after the 70s, there was some great music in the 80s, 90s, and all the way up till now. But I'm just talking about, I'm talking about a huge, what's the word? I'm such an idiot. Just a huge group of people that influenced the next generations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much stuff in the, I mean, I think there are musicians in the 80s that influenced and some in the 90s that influenced a lot of guys today. But those guys that came out of the 80s that influenced them, they were influenced by music from the 50s and 60s and 70s mm-hmm. and 40s. And we should, let me go back to the 40s because the bebop era came about there. So I should say that in the 40s, that would be more correct. But a lot of those guys, you know, a lot of the guys that influence a lot of the guys today, like Josh Redman and guys like them, those guys really went back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s to develop what they developed.
Yeah, you just mentioned the thing about some of the people today have been influenced by players of the 80s and 90s when the so-called acoustic jazz young lion movement came back and came into focus. You know, acoustic jazz in the 70s was never really dead because you had albums on black jazz, on Strata East, you know, the Herbie VSOP records, which are fantastic. I love all of those. You know, the ECM records, Jack DeJohnette, all, you know, all people like that. Acoustic jazz was always around.
I wish there were more people and really checking out. Today's younger guys were really checking all the stuff that you just mentioned. Because a lot of younger guys that I play with, I'm turning them on to names like Arthur Blythe and to the VSOP recordings and to all the things that happened in the 70s. Because, I mean, I own... In my apartment, I own about 10,000 LPs. It's about 10,000.
Wow.
And I've digitized the majority of them. And then as far as CDs go, I probably have about maybe 6,500. So my home is like a library. People come over and they just say, this is like I'm in a record store. And also a music store because I have 10 drum sets, two sets of vibes, four and a half octave marimba, four keyboards, an acoustic bass, a cello.
I got to come to
10,000 percussion instruments.
I got to come to your place sometime.
8 conga drums. Yeah, it's and it's all set up, ready to go at all times with all of the music. So there's, you know, I like to try to turn a lot of people on to a lot of these great records that you're talking about.
It's so funny that you said that you have 65,000 CDs and 10,000 records because people come to my apartment, they see my CD collection, which is only about 1,000 plus. They're like, oh, that's so huge. And I'm like, no, it isn't. You have to look at some of the people.
I'll tell you what's interesting to me, CJ, that's really crazy. I have a recording studio in my place, but I also have very nice, you know, expensive home stereo speakers. In both sides of, I have a whole floor. So on one side of the my home, I have one set of Sherwin Vegas, and on the other side, I have a set of JBLs, and they're they're big speakers. And so when you walk in, there's an incredible sound. Now I own a bunch of other speakers that I don't use anymore, and I've tried to tell guys, hey man, I got these speakers. You want to keep them in your apartment? You can. Because you're listening to music on a little computer with little computer speakers. And they're like, no, I'm good this way. Thinking to myself, this is a whole nother time. Because when I was 18 years old, everybody had to have a great stereo system in your house. That was more important than where you were going to put your clothes, you know, or where you're going to put your couch.
Sure.
And today, people listen to music on devices that are things that we wouldn't tolerate.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
I would never listen to music on a small computer speakers in my home when I was young. I wouldn't do it now, but I wouldn't do it when I was young. And I can't even give some of these speakers away. Sometimes I have like sets of them. I just don't use them. And I'll ask close friends like, hey, man, let me give you these speakers. And I got an old receiver. You can hook it up to your computer. Just plug it in there. No, I don't have much room and I'm good. I'm like, I'm going to let you just hold on to them. I mean, you probably hold on to them for years. Taken. No, I don't. It's like, really?
Yeah, you know, I have not everything, but I have a lot of my CDs ripped to my laptop, but I rip everything in Wave.
Well, that's okay, though. That's cool because you want to have an easy way to hear it.
Yeah, and personally, I still prefer putting the CD in my old Sony PlayStation 3 because it sounds better than the laptop. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with today, we're getting to the point where streaming is such a big thing that the album is a lost art, and people like myself and yourself are kind of dinosaurs because the physical product is still
Well, there was
important.
A story. There was a story that somebody that an artist was trying to. They sat there, and either them or the or in some cases a record producer or a record label. They sit there and tried to figure out a reason why they put them in the order they put them in. Mm-hmm. I never did. I would never. I never had anybody produce my. I mean, my first record I did for Quincy Jones for Warner Brothers. They let me, Styx Hooper produced it, but he kind of let me do whatever. He just was there to make sure that tape rolled and everything was cool. They let me do the order because I had a story I wanted to tell, you know. And so, yeah, that's true. It doesn't really exist anymore where people hear the whole story. Billy Childs said something that was really profound that he said about what young artists don't get to do anymore. That we got to do is we all couldn't really afford a lot of music back then. We didn't have access to hear mm-hmm. a whole record. Mm-hmm. So when you got your money together and you went and got an album, you came home, and that was like one of the albums out of maybe 10, 15 that you had. I'm talking about as a kid.
Right.
And so
right.
you listen to those albums over and over and really listen to everything on it. You know, you listen to all the bass notes, all the piano chords, all the comping, all every drum thing that went down, and
that's exactly what I did too.
Yeah, and you really studied it, and then you fell in love with it more and more. Mm-hmm, it's like going on a date with a woman one time, can't really fall in love with her, but if you can spend a whole lot of time with her, then maybe you can fall in love with her. So then, music, it doesn't. Certain records don't have the same falling in love impact because people are on to the next thing so fast.
Right. So before we wrap up here, one thing I wanted to ask.
You know, I'm not a good rapper, but I know, and I appreciate you. You know that I've done some stuff with rappers, but
You're a good beatboxer,
but I can't. Now that I can do.
Before we wrap it up, you have titled all your bands with Thrasher in them. And I find that so fascinating because actually it'll get people into jazz because people who normally won't listen to jazz will look at the name, think, oh, that's like a metal band or something like that. And they'll get into the music. So how did you come up with that?
I didn't come up with it. I got a call from Don Pullen. When Don Pullen and George Adams had their band with Cameron Brown and Danny Richmond, mm-hmm. I saw their last week in Los Angeles, and I had done some playing with Don in Los Angeles, and they got back to New York, and Danny Richmond had died a couple days on return, and the band decided they were going to go out and honor this tour that they had. So Don knew I knew the music. I'd never played with any of those guys, but because I had played with them during that week that he was in Los Angeles in the afternoon, we would go over to the Union and we'd played like four times during that week that he was in town, almost every day. And he asked me to go out with the band, and I couldn't because I was going out with my dad and Buddy DeFranco. So Don and I stayed in touch. Then Don got ready. I moved to New York. I'd moved to New York maybe a year later. And Don was going to record his record New Beginnings with Gary Peacock and Tony Williams. And
on
Tony,
Blue Note in 1985 or so. Yeah.
And that was in
86.
That actually is 88.
88.
Yeah, because that's when I first moved here. I did the rehearsals for the record. That's why I know.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Tony couldn't do the rehearsals. So I rehearsed with Don and Gary. And Don plays with his fist. You know, he rolls the back of his fist across the keys. Right. And he broke, and I can say this now because Don Sickler knows it. So if he ever hears this, he already knows the story. He basically broke two black notes off. And he asked Gary Peacock and I to go out and make sure nobody was going to walk in while he glued the black notes back on. He carried a kit with him in case this happened, because he knew this happened every once in a while. And I said to him, God, Don, you're like a thrasher. And and so and it was really funny because that, you know, so he was a thrasher. So I had a nickname when I was a kid, which was the Thrasher. I don't want to get into why. It's really stupid.
Sure.
It's really dumb. But anyways, and it was just part of a story. So then Don kind of laughed like, well, no, I'm not the Thrasher. You're the Thrasher. But Don, when I told Don the first story, when Don and George Adams were playing at Half Moon Bay, Don Poland dedicated a song to the Thrasher. And said, but the Thrasher can't expose himself right now. And then George Adams goes, yeah, let's hear it for the Thrasher. And then Danny Richmond goes, the Thrasher, come on out, Thrasher. And everybody's saying, and then the whole audience is going, Thrasher, the Thrasher, where's the Thrasher? The Thrasher. It was like a musical kind of weird thing that they did. So this Thrasher kind of, but I called him a Thrasher because he broke notes off the piano. So when I recorded for Quincy's label, I wrote a song for Don and I called it Pullen, P-U-L-L-E-N, then slash the Thrasher. And Quincy thought the title sounded sexual. And he said, can we change the title? Because this is the song that probably will be the radio hit, is Pullen the Thrasher. So can we just change it? And I said, can we call it the Thrasher and dedicate it to Don Pullen? He said, yeah, let's call it the Thrasher. And then he said, came back to me, said, we're going to call the record the Thrasher. I thought, well, that's kind of weird, because what does that mean? I'm not known as the Thrasher. And all of a sudden, you know, when you have Warner Brothers money, you go out and you do tours, they subsidize you. And so we got on our first festival in Europe, and it said Jerry Gibbs and the Thrasher Band. It was like, the Thrasher Band? Where'd that come from? And so it just kept staying. And then guys like Randy Brecker, they never would call me by my name. He still calls me Thrasher. So it just kind of, it stayed. And so we all thought, Ravi Coltrane, everybody in the band, we just thought, what are we, a heavy metal band? But we kept it, and I just kept it because more and more people would refer to me as the Thrasher.
That's a great story. That's like, in all the podcasts I've done, that's one of the best stories I've heard. So I would like to thank Jerry Gibbs so much for coming in today. And if you would like more edification on some of the topics that we talked about today, at the New York Jazz Workshop, you can check out the Modern Jazz Ensemble Workshop with Sebastian Noel, Jazz Improvisation 2 with Mark Momus, and the Funk and Fusion Workshop led by bassist Andrea Veneziani. So, for the New York Jazz Workshop in Conversation With podcast series, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.